Hello, and welcome to The Library Coven, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties discuss mostly YA fantasy through the lens of intersectional feminist criticism. Why? Because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly. In our final episode, we're discussing the much-anticipated new novel by Hafsa Faisal, A Tempest of Tea. We meet Arthi Kazimir.
Arthi.
Okay, you listen to the audiobook, yeah. So thank you. We meet Arthi Kazimir and her crew who run a tea house turned blood house called Spindrift in the city of White Roaring. When Spindrift is threatened, Arthi is forced to make alliances and pull off a dangerous heist. There are vampires, colonial shenanigans, forgeries, intrigue galore. The book ends on a serious cliffhanger, or like series of cliffhangers, I would say.
Yeah.
And we don't know when to expect the next installment, so we will wait with bated breath.
Initial reactions. I listened to the audiobook, which Kelly just mentioned, which was narrated by Maya Soraya, and 5 out of 5 stars. What a book to end the show with. Totally. I loved it so much. I'll admit I was a little nervous because I loved We Hunt the Flame so much, and I wasn't sure how a new series would go, but it was amazing. And I'm just so happy that we, you know, are wrapping up with this book.
I couldn't agree more. I read the print book and like, it was so good. Damn. There were so many twists that I didn't see coming, which we'll talk about. The world building was like super vibrant. Such good pining. You could cut the sexual tension with a knife. Like, I think Faisal does that really well. I loved it. I'm definitely going to be recommending this one because I feel like it would go for people who like YA and people who don't. It didn't feel like pigeonholed into YA to me.
Speaking of recommending, recommend if you like. I feel like you led us into that real well.
Yeah. Segue.
I would say Saba Tahir if you like books that deal with colonialism, set in a magical world, but also bring in like cultural aspects.
I think that's a really good one. Yeah.
Definitely Peaky Blinders, which is how Hafsa marketed this book as Peaky Blinders with vampires. Although this book is way less violent than Peaky Blinders. I love Peaky Blinders, and I think like the ambiance, the vibes of both the show and this book, they go together. So yeah.
I'm also going to add Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom because Arthi was giving me Kaz Brekker vibes.
100%.
So yeah, I would add those two in there.
So why did we choose this book? We should probably say up front that we didn't know when we created the schedule that this would be our final episode, but we both loved We Hunt the Flames, so we wanted to continue with Hafsa's book, and I think it's a pretty good one to have a book that we love come at the end, so that just kind of worked out.
Yeah, it really did. Time to talk about world building in Through the Wardrobe.
So the book takes place in a continent called Atenia, and it's an empire that's been built off the spoils of colonialism, which is probably most salient to Arthi in the story. I feel like we get a lot of these kinds of books like that deal with colonialism written by like people of color. Mm-hmm. So no surprises that Hafsa would take this on in her book.
Yeah. One thing I liked is that we were expanding beyond Arawiya, which was the continent that the first duology was set in, but it's like still in the same fictional universe. So like in the map, I don't know if you had like a PDF or anything that came with your audiobook, but like the map at the beginning shows that, let me turn to it. Like, first of all, look at this gorgeous city map of White Roaring.
Nice.
Very pretty, right? I'm showing Jessie on the video. Let's see. And then there was one of like the continent. Where did it go?
Oh, I think it was in the upper right hand corner of the city.
Oh, yeah. But you can kind of see that it's like an island nation. Atenia is an island nation to the north of a large continent called Arawiya that extends off the map. So yeah, I appreciate how there were definitely like using parts of IRL, you know, history and geopolitics and dynamics that then informed this fictional universe, and I think that was done successfully.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned it later in the show notes. I don't remember because I wrote them a long time ago now. But the audiobook had an interview at the end with Hafsa and her husband, which was really cute. He had like very good questions for her about the books and stuff, and she kind of talked about like how some of this came from her family's history of colonialism in Sri Lanka. So I didn't know that she was Sri Lankan, but I just thought that was really interesting to like kind of bring that in, like, you know, the effects that, you know, generations of people feel still now, lots of time later. Colonialism just has like these long lasting effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We also have a tea shop, Spindrift, in this book, which I thought was really fun. It's a tea house during the day and a blood house for vampires at night. And I just liked this idea so much. It was like really cute, even though I know like they're literally getting blood, I'm guessing, from people. But I really liked this aspect, although it was like fun and like 1920s America prohibition-esque. Like that was a cool like little spin, no pun intended, on like that.
Totally. I thought that I was just like fascinated by the scenes where they're like flipping tables down or flipping booths up, and you know, like I'm imagining like secret compartments in the walls, and yeah, just like all of these cool little machinations that they do to like flip essentially the tea house into the blood house. I thought that was really cool.
Let's discuss all things magic. I wrote vampires and coconuts, which was such a weird thing to write, but like they're vampires, half vampires, and for some reason it turns out vampires can live off coconut milk instead of blood, which was just odd to me. Like I was like, what a strange choice. I don't like that was not discussed in Hofstra's interview, but I do want to be like, why coconuts of all things? So that part like was really funny to me.
Yeah, it seemed almost like a silver bullet there at the end, like this magical, not cure, but yeah, it was one of the mechanisms that I didn't see any of the like twists about Arthi coming. We'll talk about that later. No. But now that I know in retrospect, I can see the like breadcrumbs, you know, with her drinking her decanter of coconut milk or whatever every day or something.
Yeah, and I didn't think of anything of it. Also, probably because like coconuts play such a big role in like Southeast Asian cuisine, that I was just like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That
sure, yeah, exactly. Same. I was just like, sure, coconuts, drink coconut milk, great.
Yeah. We also have Calibor, which is this like magical gun that Arthi has that can turn into other weapons, and like whose bullets can kill anything, including vampires. But it's also like some ploy set up by the monarchy in order to make money off of tourism, because there was like an Excalibur situation going on with the gun, and like it was like different, and I didn't expect anything like vaguely close to Arthurian coming into this story. So it was just like an interesting like little tidbit in there that I was like, oh, I did not see this coming. There were a lot of things that I was just like, oh, I didn't think this would be the case.
Yeah, this was one of those where I was, you know, thinking that like maybe Arthi is just magical, but then turns out that this is a magical artifact, probably from Arawea, that Laith has been long game trying to like get from her the whole time. All right, now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, good and evil in Get Me Kylo Ren. The usual suspects here today.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. Colonialism and racism. Arthi ended up in Atenea after trying to flee a massacre by the colonizers. And then most of the crew are POC. And there are a lot of discussions about the way that they stand out in Atenea and how they're treated differently because they're POC. So it was nice to see these conversations going on, because sometimes I think in a fantasy setting, if it's not set in like our real world, these kind of conversations don't always happen. So it was nice to see like that this was still included, because it makes it, I think, like super obvious, especially for younger readers, like what's going on.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, going off of that on a similar note, museums have to be in here because they're just like filled with colonial plunder. And I loved the part of Arthi and Co's backstory where they robbed this place called the Curio, which is like already exhibitionist and like weird, you know, it's like cabinet of curiosities, right? I'm going to collect all of this stuff that was stolen from other people and just like put it up to look at.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like loses, it's not being like used in ceremony or like appreciated in, you know, ways that the home cultures would do it. It's just like this strange white colonial voyeurism that is like still going strong now. But I loved that, and a little bit of like wish fulfillment with Arthi liberating the colonial plunder.
Oh, yeah. And then I think kind of in that vein, we have the ram, who is literally like this mass monarch no one knows the identity of. So like, this is a very strange monarchy situation going on. But it turns out like the ram is Flick's mom, which I didn't see coming. And she's been kidnapping vampires, starving them, and then setting them loose to fight wars on her behalf. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I didn't see that coming at all. Like, but it was like such a good plot point, because I was like, oh, that's like such a different way to like use vampires as weapons that I haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. Like, not that it's a good thing, but I was just like, oh, I hadn't seen someone do this before. Like, nice touch, Hafsa.
Yeah, it's just like so nefarious, and just goes to show how this oppressive power structure is taking a quote-unquote problem, which is like vampires, and using the fear-mongering around it, and like constructing a situation in which they, yeah, it's like a problem to be solved, quote-unquote, and then their solution is like, go make more money off of them, or go like continue the cycle of like colonial plunder with these people, right? And something that I was reading that was, you know, all the conversations about like immigration and how Arthi and crew are treated and stuff made me think about like, you know, this discourse that we have now about essentially like vampirism, right? Of the like white fragile imagination is that like they're, you know, bleeding us dry of resources or whatever, when it's like, no, we are the people who are plundering and exploiting the land currently. And like, we are the vampires. I'm talking about myself as like a white person, right? White settlers, you know, versus this like they're taking our jobs sort of rhetoric, when it's like, no. Yeah. I just thought that like that kind of maps on well, the like whole conversation about vampirism and who is and who isn't like maybe taking resources without consent.
Yeah, which I think rolls very nicely into your next point.
It's true. Lady Lyndon, which is Flick's mom, who is also the ram, who is also the hashtag girl boss of the East Givant Company, which, you know, maps onto like the East India Company or the Dutch East India Company, seem to like have a historical basis in that. Lady Lyndon just struck me as like peak white feminism, you know, just wanting like equal opportunity to be a mega oppressor. And I appreciate how we see Flick deconstructing this like view that she had of her mom that was like all sunny and rosy, and then realizing that, oh, wait, she's been up to like some serious shenanigans. That Flick is like kind of calibrating her own moral compass and deciding, you know, what to do now that she has information, the correct information about her past. And yeah, realizing that she was also being used. She was being used by her adopted mother.
Yeah, just terrible all around. Mm-mm.
The last point that I put in here is the use of the adjective exotic. It came up at the very end. I noticed it at the very end, but I think it had been like sprinkled throughout. And it's just, yeah, lazy and often racist. So let's be more specific, team, you know. And that's like the point Arthi is making, right? You could like name an actual city or province or country or ethnic group or cultural tradition. You better be doing better than a continent. Like,
yeah, you would think.
Don't just say Africa. Like, come on, people. Mm-hmm. There's like, so it's not a monolith. But yeah, I thought that I don't know, there were a lot of conversations happening in this book that I thought like made these sorts of topics like would make them super accessible to a younger, you know, cohort of readers. And
yeah,
let's be honest, like a cohort of readers that are probably already on this page, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the young people will save us, maybe. Onward, magical friends. Just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, gender, and ability. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. So there is a lot of classism and anti-immigrant sentiment playing out in this book. And I think we've kind of like touched on that a little bit. So the Aetherium are like the vampire royals, and they look down on like the lower class of vampires. And then there's also a lot of talk about who does and doesn't belong in Etenya, which maps onto people who immigrated from other, i.e. brown countries. So yeah, there's like a lot going on in here that I think maybe didn't come up as much in We Hunt the Flame, or at least not that I remember. Yeah, so anyways, I just thought this was an interesting way to like bring this in, especially thinking about the classes between different like groups of people.
Definitely. And I appreciated how, like, the vampires weren't immune to this class hierarchy either, because I think in other stories it seems like, and it makes sense, like, if you're a vampire, you would then have unlimited opportunities to accumulate generational wealth, especially if you're white, right? But I liked how there was, you know, the same class hierarchies where the vampires were also dealing with, you know, as well as the humans. And there was a quote on page 48 that stuck out to me, and this is Arthi's exposition. She, a lower class immigrant, was successful, and that made people mad.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. But it's just like getting to the core of the issue. The book also is like fitting in these, it's like a different version of a narrative of like what brown people in the imperial core and what their experiences are and how they can sort of upset the status quo and necessarily like very needed. It reminds me of Babel by R.F. Kuang in that way as well.
In the story, Flick is adopted, which funny enough, I don't think we see very often like in the books that we read. And related to that, we see her dealing with the feelings of her like mom, her adopted mom, not loving her anymore. We don't really get like a ton of backstory about the adoption, like how that works. So maybe we'll see that more in the next book. But I just thought it's funny because we do read a lot of YA with dead parents. So yeah. It's kind of funny that we don't see more adoption happening in YA books. Yeah. So something I maybe would like to see, you know, especially from people who have been adopted, like authors, you know, who have been adopted, just to like have a realistic expression of that situation. So yeah, I just thought this was interesting to pull in because we don't see it very often.
Totally. And it gets even more interesting because it's like an what do they call it? Like cross-racial adoption, interracial, right? Because her mom's white, but Flick is POC.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like so many, you could mine that for so many like different problems and, you know, discussions and so much there that wasn't touched on in the novel, and I didn't think it needed to be necessarily. But yeah, that is also something to explore, especially because we're getting more and more conversations now that like people, I guess, in like adoptees in our generation who were, you know, adopted from China or elsewhere to white parents, you know, and then like confronting their white parents about, you know, a lot of the problems that are inherent in this sort of in the business that is international adoption, let's be honest.
Well, and just the loss of their culture. Yeah, transracial adoption's a little sticky, probably.
Transracial. That's the word. That's the word. I got my prefixes wrong. Yeah, totally. Especially when it's just like you are willing to shell out like $40,000 or something, but you're not willing to like give the people on the ground $40,000 so they can like have a life with their family intact. It feels very like selfish, et cetera, et cetera. So
white people gonna wait.
For real, for real. I always appreciate some light gender fuckery, which we had in the book. I think mainly in Arthi and Mateo, like Arthi's gender presentation wearing, like I was imagining essentially like Peaky Blinders, like Shelby, Tommy Shelby, basically like dressing like him, you know, and I'm
100%
her like perfectly tailored vests and just stuff like that. Just looking immaculate.
Suspenders.
Yes. Like the rolled up sleeves, the cap, you know, just all the things.
Yep, yep.
We've got like Mateo's undead artist boy vibes, you know?
Yeah.
With just like a little, yeah, it just felt very queer to me, both of them with their gender presentations, even though sexuality wise, maybe it's not turning out that way.
Yeah, it's funny because I imagine Mateo is kind of like, what is his name? From Robert Sheehan in Umbrella Academy. Is it Klaus? Is that his name in the show?
Yes, yes. That's exactly it.
That's how I imagine Mateo.
Yeah, exactly. Klaus is a great comparison. We also get this like this figure of Penn at the end, which we realize Arthi had been like quasi adopted by this person and then had run away from him, and he's just like one of the he's like the most powerful vampire at the Aetherium. He was like ancient and stuff. And then there's this conversation when they're like trying to take down the ram and they have the journal and they're like teaming up for the final showdown, that like Penn wants to like toe a specific ethical line and essentially play into respectability politics by seeking justice for vampires through the courts and existing institutions. And then we, at the same time, we see like those in power have no such standards and act with like total impunity I kind of read this as like a master's tools, master's house situation to riff off of Audre Lorde, mm-hmm. like wanting to use the courts and go through the existing channels in order to appeal to some sort of sense of goodness or respectability that like those in power are not willing to, like, they don't care. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I appreciate that this was in there and that we see like a diversity of tactics being played out in the story.
Yes. I don't remember this pen person. I've already forgotten. But this sounds right. Yeah, we'll go with it.
I just finished it. I could tell you he's there.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, it's me again. I'm just drinking tea over here on topic. Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own.
I don't really have like strong feelings about any of the couples / thruples in the story. I kind of like Mateo, I guess he's fine. And like, and I forget what the other, Leif, like I was kind of like, yeah. A little suspicious. Maybe, oh, what are these little, like her guy sidekick's name?
Jin.
Yes, like Jin and Flick. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm on board for that, I think. But there's just like a lot of pining and sexual tension when you kind of mentioned at the beginning that I just wasn't expecting for some reason. So like, yeah, I just wasn't expecting it. And I was like, oh, wow, this is so much more than I thought I would get. So I'll take it.
Yeah, like very little on the page action. But no. At the same time, it was like so much bubbling beneath the surface. So I like wasn't necessarily mm-hmm. missing it. Right. Because I'm like, ooh, it was yeah. teased for a long time. Yeah. I also have yeah. similarly ambivalent about the couples / thruples. But
yeah.
Love the pining. The tension was next level good. I remember that being something that Faisal did really well in the first duology. And yeah, did it again here. You know, we love on the show, we love a chosen and found family mm-hmm. narrative, which is definitely what we have here with the Spindrift crew, especially when it's a group of anti-colonial misfits, which, yes, rob those museums, take back those artifacts. And speaking of anti-colonial, free Palestine.
Yeah. Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind and kill your darlings. Okay, so like I mentioned before, I listened to the audiobook and it had an interview at the end. And Hafsa said she thought it might be obvious that Arthi was a half vampire, like pretty early on. But I didn't see that coming at all. Also, Arthi turns Jin at the end. I finished the book and was like, why did I read this when I have no idea when a sequel is coming out? Like, this just feels so unfair. And like in the interview, Hafsa was like, I think she mentioned that she hadn't started writing the second one yet. And I was just like, but what's going to happen? I need to know.
Inquiring minds need to know. I didn't see any of these twists coming. Maybe there were breadcrumbs, you know, now that we're, you know, hindsight 2020. But
yeah,
I thought it was cool that she was able to like craft that sense of intrigue and keep us guessing. Yeah, I want more interviews at the end of audiobooks. I think that's so cool. More bonus content.
Yes, please.
I've never heard of that before. Have you?
I don't think. Okay, sometimes when the book ends, I'm not going to lie, I'm just like, all right, that's done. I don't need to. So it's possible next. That I missed it. I have read some books that had like an interview at the end, but usually like from like, you know, someone at the publishing house or like another author. And it was just like really sweet and cute for it to be like Hafsa and her husband, because like people love them also, like on, you know, social media or whatever. They seem really cute and sweet and nice. And it was fun to read an interview where the two people were so close, because you could tell they felt really like comfortable talking to each other.
It's like listening in on a podcast. Yeah. It's like they're your parasocial besties, mm-hmm, even mm-hmm. though you don't know them at all. Yeah, and like with Leif at the end being the Wolf of White Roaring, I guess it all makes sense, right? Because like, why would you introduce such an important figure and then like not tie it back in?
Yeah.
But we were fooled.
Was Leif in the other, like in the Sands of Arawaya? I couldn't remember.
I can't remember either.
Okay, perfect.
So who knows? Maybe yes, maybe no.
Okay. Obviously, it's been a while since I read like the Sands of Arawaya stories, but like I feel like Hafsa's writing has gotten even better than before. Like something about it, I was just like, wow, the writing just seems to like have been elevated. And I don't know if it's just because like as you continue in your practice of writing, you just like continually get better. But as I was reading it, I was just like, the lines, like the descriptions, like everything, I was just like, oh man, this is really, really good. So that's all. All the love in the world to Hafsa.
I second that completely. I got to talk about some of the visual aspects of the book, because like the cover, the dust covered, the map, the parasexual, that's my sexuality apparently, paratextual materials, like in the, here, I can show you. Did you thumb through a physical copy of the book?
No, I got it from the library to take pictures and then sent it on its way.
And then didn't crack the spine. No. But like there's different, it's separated into acts. And then
on
the acts, they have like their plans for the heist in like script.
I like that.
And some drawings and stuff, Mateo's drawings. So, you know, I'm like total slut for that sort of thing. So
yeah,
loved it.
Tracks.
Loved it. And also on a very random note, Spindrift Pineapple is my current bubbly water of choice flavor, so not an ad, not sponsored, but
although I feel like maybe Hafsa should be, because as I was reading that, I was like, oh, a Spindrift does sound good. I like the lime. I think that one's my favorite.
Lime. I like how they, you know, taste like actual fruit instead of like someone's whispering a fruit from the next room vaguely.
that's a hit against LaCroix.
Oh, shots fired.
Yeah. Before we end, it's time for a real talk. Did reading this book make your perspective change in any way, or did it make you interrogate a concept, system, or trend that you hadn't before? Kelly, just for you, I made sure to have something here in our final. I've got nothing really, but there's this line from Mateo that said, every good story starts with a bullet to the heart. And I was like, I need more of these vibes in books. So if anyone has suggestions, like this is real enemies to lover. Like, I don't know why this line stuck out to me. I had to rewind and like write it down because I was like, oh, I like this a lot.
Every good love story starts with a bullet to the heart.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you for that, Hafsa.
I have a quote, obviously. I just wanted to be nothing if not consistent here at the end. There's a quote on page 77, and I believe it's Arthi's exposition, and saying, ignorance had always been a defining feature of the privileged.
Yeah. Are we seeing it now more than ever?
We really are. And Hafsa with these like one-liners, you know, just getting to the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can like speak from personal experience that this is 100% a thing. And like one of the gateways out for me, I like would never have been exposed to anything besides my like, I don't know, white, bourgeois, suburban, like settler colonial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Had I not like read stuff, you know, just read like super far outside of, you know, my culture of origin. I think that one of the many reasons why books are magical is that it can like change your whole, it can turn your world like all the way upside down, you know, so that you actually see how you fit in the larger scheme of things instead of just staying in your like cozy little microcosm that's super comfortable.
Final card questions.
The final ones. Let's see what the cards have in store for us today. How did the author get you interested?
By writing two amazing books before this one.
With that sexy ass cover.
Yeah, cover vibes.
Bisexual flag vibe. paratextual materials. Love those. Map. And also a good story. Ooh, this is a good one. If this book had a soundtrack, what music would it be?
Oh, I think it would be fun to have, so I see this on TikTok sometimes where people make videos like with music that come from their culture. So I think it could be cool to have like Sri Lankan music just because like that is kind of what Hafsa had based it on. And I feel like I'm not familiar with what the music from Sri Lanka sounds like at all, but I just think that's kind of fun and like a different way to learn about a place is to have music from that place.
100%. Love it. Oh yeah, I'm imagining like Sri Lankan music and then meets like Peaky Blinders, mm-hmm. like kind of bar sort of music. You
yeah.
Know?
Yeah. Emo.
Yeah, exactly. Grungy a little bit. All right. How was sex or the lack of sex used in the book?
I mean, it's all just pining. It's just tension.
Desire is simmering.
Yes. But I think it sets it up for, like, you know, the next book, because obviously I assume it's all going to culminate in all the people who want to be together being together, because that's what happened in The Sands of Arawaya, which I really enjoyed. So, yeah. I mean, I think I need more enemies to lovers in the next book, but I don't know that that's going to happen. So it's just my favorite trope.
They're starting to be friends now. So
yeah, I know.
They were enemies in this book and now they're friends, right? At the end.
I don't need the friends part.
We've done it. We've reached the end. I'm so proud of, like, what we've co-created and, like, grateful for the connections that we've made with people over the years. So, you know, we're not going to give our regular spiel. Instead, we're going to say where you can find us after the fact. So I'm still making audio content with Outsources, which is a queer producer collective for my local community radio station, KGNU. You can go to kgnu.org/outsources for our show archive of rad interviews with cool queers. Or you can hit me up via the contact form on my website, which is kellyjdrumwright.com, J the letter. And it's like drumwright, drum as in the instrument, write as in the direction, no W. And I'm not really on Insta and can't say when or if I'll be back on there, but my handle is @kdrumleft.
If you want to chat or just follow along with other happenings in my life, and possibly a book review every now and then, no promises, you can follow my knitting account on Instagram @jessie.mae.knits, or all of my baking adventures @jessie.mae.bakes on Instagram, or the same username without the dots on TikTok for my baking content. We'll be closing down our Patreon account, but we hope that you continue to support other creators who bring you joy and shopping at your local bookstores when you can, or bookshop.org, not at our affiliate page, but elsewhere when you get the chance. Thank you for being a part of our coven. Stay magical.
Stay magical.
We did it.